This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Face Connecticut. I'm Morgan Cunningham on WTIC News Talk 1080, Light 100.5 WRCH, and 96.5 TIC. Our guest this morning is Quinnipiac University political science professor Jonathan Pelto. And the reason we're bringing Jonathan on this morning is because of his connection, previously working as a legislator, with former Connecticut Governor Jody Rell. Jody Rell, who did many more things than just be governor. She was lieutenant governor. She was also a state representative as well. And they go back to 1985 together. Governor Rell, by the way, laid to rest just this past week. At the age of 78, she had died from a brief and relatively sudden illness as well. According to her family, she was down in Florida when that happened. Professor Pelto, welcome to the program. Thank you for coming on.
No, thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on the program, and particularly to talk about Jody Rell, who was such an important figure at the time when she took over the governorship, but also just generally brought a kinder, gentler style that we really no longer see in American politics. So it's an honor to be able to talk about her legacy and her impact here in Connecticut.
You really don't see it, do you? And I think to understand her story, which you were there for the beginning of in her early political years, let's go back to 1985, I think it was. The two of you were elected to serve together in the state legislature.
Yeah, we both ran in 1984. We didn't know each other. We were just about as far apart geographically and in some ways ideologically or partisanship. She was had risen up or had been active at the local level and ran for state legislature in 1984, as did I. But I came from northeastern Connecticut, from the 54th House District, over in, which includes Storrs, and was one of a handful of very liberal candidates who were running in Democratic primaries, a little bit like the squad. In fact, at the time, we were called the Gang of Four when we were sworn in 1985, and she was sworn in, and we quickly realized that the freshman class was pretty small and spent a lot of time talking with each other, and that there was a lot more common ground than I think any of us realized, and kept up many of those relationships for years and decades. So I had a chance to really see her grow into the job, but never sort of change her fundamental approach, which was very no-nonsense, hardworking. She certainly, from her perspective, was a typical Republican, might even have classified herself as somewhat conservative, but it was a type of Republican that we rarely see, even in states like Connecticut. She was pro-choice. She signed, first person to sign a bill recognizing civil unions. So when we, in the country, the first person to sign it. So when we talk about Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, in 1985, it was a very different definition than what we would call today of the polarization of Democrat and Republican, liberal and conservative. And that allowed her to have a much more successful career in Connecticut politics, because she was able to garner not only strong Republican support, but overwhelming support from unaffiliated voters and even significant support from Democrats when she ran for governor on her own in 2006.
There's something else that I want to bring up concerning her earliest years. I have heard from a number of people who knew her at that time or were covering state politics at that time. There was no indication that she was hoping to seek some kind of higher office like governorship or anything even beyond that in that era. That, you know, sometimes you have a politician that wants to move up the political ladder, so to speak. And in those earliest years, I've been told that that wasn't necessarily something that she was pursuing. Do you agree with that? Did you see anything in her that said, gee, she's going to be a great governor someday?
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation and, again, is pretty uncommon. I mean, these days, first off, to run for office is a major endeavor. To move up within the political infrastructure is a major endeavor, and most, if not all, politicians have lots of goals to be successful and move from one level to the next. And we see a lot of politicians who have successfully done that. She certainly did not fit that mold. In fact, even as governor, I would say that while she had a steady hand and wasn't afraid to take on major issues, she never, that I recall, positioned herself in a way that she was thinking, okay, this will lead to the next step. That it was almost, I wouldn't say accidental is too strong a term, because she was certainly willing to step up and serve in the capacities that she was needed in. But we don't have a lot of examples these days of people who went to, in this case, Hartford, as a state representative, to do the best she could for her community, and didn't, to my knowledge, have any plans. In fact, I would argue that John Rowland, who was running, had run, lost, and then ran again in 1994, had picked her because she was not a threat in any way, and was seen as a known quantity, although not widely known, despite having served in the legislature for 10 years. I wouldn't say that she had ever appeared to be somebody who had higher aspirations. And Rowland, who was a particular kind of politician that liked that, what we would now refer to as a strong governor, or if it was a mayor, a strong mayor, that is wanting to make his decisions and get his way. And I can't speak for him, but I think a lot of people felt that he had picked her because she would not be nipping at his heels in any way. And then, of course, she became governor when he was on the precipice of getting impeached and eventually resigned and went to prison. And I think she herself had said that while she was extraordinarily disappointed in what Rowland had done, she had not seen herself as the next governor, but in fact was sort of forced into that situation. And when she ran for re-election, that it was in 2006, she did so sort of to carry on the work that she had already started in 2005. So even then, I don't get the sense that she said, okay, I need to be governor, and then, of course, did not seek re-election in 2010. It was a particularly difficult economic climate after the economic problems of 2008 and 2009 across the country. Programs needed to be cut, budgets and taxes needed to be raised, and she had been so popular that I think there was sort of a widespread expectation that she would not run because it would have been such a difficult race. She probably could have won again, but it was going to be a very different environment than anything she had ever seen, and so she did not seek re-election in 2010.
First of all, she is the last Republican to hold statewide office in Connecticut. And the other thing that I want to point out is that, to date, she's the only second female governor in Connecticut. The first one, former Governor Ella Grasso, passed away in February 1981, which was only a few years before Jody Rell entered politics in the state. And we have heard numerous people consider Governor Rell to be a trailblazer in a way, much like Ella Grasso was in the 1970s and early 1980s. Do you think that that weighed any impact on her, the way she acted, the way she approached politics, that she was the second female governor in Connecticut? Or do you think that she just approached the job because it was the job she had to do?
There's no doubt she was a trailblazer and broke the glass ceiling for a lot of women politicians, just as Ella did. Ella and her had very different styles. Ella was somebody who would literally kick down the door, and Jody Rell was somebody who was not only sort of knocking at the door, but the door was then opened because of her style of looking to get along, to work with people, to be open to compromise. And so they had extraordinarily different styles. And in that sense, I would say that it helped broaden the definition of what women politicians could utilize to get elected at the highest levels of government. So in that sense, plus her sort of steady hand at the helm when she was governor, did certainly set a way that a style that could be replicated going forward. Any of us who were involved in politics in the late 70s and early 80s were influenced directly or indirectly by Ella Grasso, especially on the Democratic side, because, of course, she was a Democrat. But women across the state saw Ella as somebody who refused to just sit on the sidelines, which is what in many respects had happened. There was little windows of opportunity. A Secretary of the State was seen as a job that was, quote unquote, given to a woman candidate. And certainly Ella had shown that you could be a win a congressional seat. But what Jody Rell brought to the table was not somebody who was trying to move up the ladder, but somebody who was trying to get the job done and done right. I recall a number of conversations with her while she was still a state representative, one in particular that stays with me, and that is my first daughter was born in 1993, and when I brought my newborn to the Capitol, there was, of course, you bring your child and you introduce them, and there was lots of congratulatory comments. But up until that point, I had been much more of a politician that was trying to move up, that I was sort of that classic politician. And I had a really interesting conversation with Jody Rell, who valued her role as a mother of two young children as equally important, as vital, maybe, I won't even say maybe, as more important, but also being able to do the job of state representative. But she cautioned how hard that was and how much she missed in being involved in some of her children's activities. And I actually ended up resigning midterm in September to be able to be a more hands-on parent. And also at that point, the legislature only paid $20,000 a year. So trying to be a parent and have a family and not have the income. And I was really moved by her report that it is great to be a parent and great to be a state representative, but in order to do it right, you had to give up a lot of your time with your children. And her children were at a position where she was comfortable doing that, but sort of, I wouldn't say lectured me, but certainly pointed out that there were important decisions to make when one became a parent if they were also a state representative. And that, to me, says a lot about keeping things in perspective. And so that was the first thing that really jumped out, and that's one of the biggest things that jumped out. The other is the idea that when you sit down at the table, the goal is not to win at all costs and beat your opponent into oblivion. What you're working for is to find common ground and compromise. And she did that as a state legislator. I don't think John Rowland gave her a lot of authority as lieutenant governor, but as governor, the whole hallmark of her time as governor was one of consensus building and compromise, and the legacy that she leaves behind, interestingly, includes a number of compromises that at least Republicans today would definitely oppose, would have voted against, and yet she had an ability to work across party lines in a way that I just don't see done at any level in the United States today. And there are numerous examples of that in when she was governor, where we the people ended up the beneficiaries of a policy that was had both Democrat and Republican elements in it that just would not be a compromise that could be reached in today's political environment.
I'm Morgan Cunningham. It's Face Connecticut. And if you're just joining us, we're remembering the late Governor Jody Rell, who passed away at the age of 78 at the end of November and was laid to rest just this past week. And my guest is Jonathan Pelto in the Political Science Department, a professor at Quinnipiac University, who once served with Governor Rell long before she was Governor Rell back in the 1980s and early 1990s. I want to focus a little bit on the year 2004, which, as we have mentioned a few times, Professor Pelto, was very transitional for Connecticut, for her political career, and very consequential as well. And one of the first things that she did when she took over the governor's office for Governor Rell when he stepped down over that scandal was that she held an open house at the state capitol, and anybody who wanted to meet her, share their concerns with her, could come and meet her. And I'll also add that she was very human. She kicked her shoes off because her feet were hurting too, and she got a lot of remarks and applause for doing that, hey, she's just a person herself too. Could you comment on that moment that many people consider to be bold for her to do?
Yeah, I would say that it was typical of her and representative of her, and that, you know, all these years later, it's understandably and rightfully held out as an example, but that was who Jody Rell was. As things sort of spiraled out of control with Governor Rowland, and it became increasingly clear that he would eventually or likely be going to prison for his actions, it was just a question of what was the order of events. There was a committee that was formed to impeach him. There was bipartisan recognition that that needed to happen, that that was moving to the final stages, at which point he then resigned and she became governor, and he went on then to plead guilty and go off to prison. And so she was very much thrust into not only being governor and the head of the executive branch and responsible for implementing all of the laws of the state of Connecticut and for running the budget with billions of dollars, and going through whatever we could do or might do as through a healing process. And so that meeting with open house, meeting with constituents, being very open to input, as you said, famously kicking off her shoes and saying, let's do this, let's have these conversations, set the tone for what came for over the next couple of years. And we probably, at that point, adopted the single most important ethics and campaign finance reform bill in certainly Connecticut history. And the campaign finance portion, and the ethics portion for that matter, was one of, if not the most far-reaching bills in the country. So we went from, as a state, from a point where our elected governor was about to go to prison to one where we had a set of laws in place that arguably something like that could never happen again. And as I said, that would not have happened had it not been for A, Jody Rell's leadership style, her willingness to work across party lines, but also her personal style of kicking off her shoes and saying, okay, let's get to work. I remember that she was not a fan of the campaign finance portion of the package. There was an ethics portion that made it illegal, four made it clarified that politicians can't get gifts, that they can't personally benefit from being in office, something that John Rowlands had done, that state contractors could not be involved in the campaign process. But it also included a campaign finance bill that was so far-reaching that it became the model for the United States at the state level, that just completely rewrote the way in which campaigns are financed at the state level. And she did not support that. She felt that it was going too far. In fact, the Republicans were very much against it, and yet she recognized that in order to get the changes that we needed as a state and put in the circuit breakers to make sure that we put the Rowland era behind us, she was willing to negotiate a bill that was opposed by most, if not all, Republicans, and yet was the right thing to do. The Democrats didn't get everything they wanted. She didn't get everything she wanted. But she got a package that truly transformed. I mean, the word transformative is a term that's often used too often these days, but it transformed Connecticut politics. And it could not have happened had it not been for Rell's style and willingness to not fall into Democrat versus Republican, liberal versus conservative. Your description of that day that she took office and had the open house is really a placeholder for a much broader approach than simply that.
I also want to ask you about her legacy going forward, and we're down to the last few moments, so this might be our last question, but in the last week I've heard from some people who have said that with this upcoming legislative session, the budget is going to be harder than it has been the last few years, where we don't have the COVID money, etc., and that they're going to be channeling their inner Jody Rell to figure out how to deal with the budget for 2025-2026.
That's a great description, and we would all, we as a state, would do very well if that was the case. I'm not sure there's ever going to be, at least in this political environment, a Jody Rell approach that survives. But I would summarize it as, okay, we got a job to do, let's get the job done. As governor, she had proposed, in fact, a major tax increase that would have properly funded education. It ended up falling apart because of Republican opposition, and she actually withdrew her support. But then 2 years later, when we did have a budget like the one they will be facing now, there had to be, it was a very hard budget to pass in 2008, and she ended up using a technique that is very unusual, but was what needed to happen, and that was the only way to get a budget passed a Democratic-controlled legislature, a Republican governor, was she negotiated the best budget she could from her perspective, and then she allowed the bill, which was the budget, to go into law without her signature or a veto. It's a procedure that is rarely used. And that is, I don't support this, but we have to do it. And that got us across the finish line as a state and allowed the state to then go into a much more prosperous period after that. And so when people say you got to do what you got to do the right job and refer to Jody Rell, they're not only referring to somebody who was pro-choice and, as I said, supported gay rights, but she did what needed to be done with the budget, even in the face of tremendous opposition from her own party, but knowing that at that point she had to rise above the political fray. So we would do well if the Connecticut Democrats and Republicans, legislature and governor, said, yeah, we're going to put on the Jody Rell approach and do what's right for Connecticut rather than what is politically expedient.
I really appreciate your time this morning, political science professor Jonathan Pelto at Quinnipiac University, who had the chance to serve with M. Jody Rell, Connecticut's former governor who passed away recently at the age of 78. Thank you for coming on and remembering her with us.
Thank you.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.